I think that anybody out there who's ever worked on a set would not use the word healthy to describe the culture of it.
Hi, I'm Zena Harris, a founder and entrepreneur working in the entertainment industry for more than 10 years now.
And I'm Mark Raven, a two-time founder and innovator in the energy tech industry and spent the last decade powering films, events, and festivals with renewable energy.
Welcome to The Tie-In. Today, we are talking with Becky Morrison, who is the founder and CEO of The Light, an award-winning New York and LA production company focused on films, series, and high-end commercials.
Becky, welcome to The Tie-In.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark and Zena. And hi, everybody out there who's listening.
I know. We're really excited to talk to you. So to set the stage a little bit, can we start with an origin story or a little context around who you are, what you do?
Sure. Yeah. As you mentioned, I own a commercial production company called The Light, and I got my start as a production assistant in New York. So I was somebody who, I grew up in Manhattan. I grew up seeing things filming all the time on the streets of New York. I think like many people, I was like, how do I get in? Like, how do I work on a film set? It seemed very like impenetrable. I went to film school, but that didn't help, actually. I still couldn't get a job on a film set. And I had a friend who was a production assistant. Her dad was an AD in LA, and she had been working as a PA. And she wasn't available on a job and asked if she should recommend me. Of course, I was like, yeah. And I remember the coordinator at the time called me and she said, oh, you know, you were recommended. Are you an office PA or a set PA? And I was like, yeah, whatever you need. That's me. I didn't even really understand the difference. I was like, that. She's like, OK, I'll bring you in the office. And immediately when I got into the production office, I had found my tribe.
Really?
All my personality traits, like making lists and color coding things, which had been like mocked by my friends for years, suddenly were like an asset in the production office. So I just fell in love with production.
Yeah. And, you know, the fast paced nature of it all and like decisions, you know, like all of that kind of stuff. Super exciting. Pressure cooker.
Pressure cooker, yeah.
You came on my radar a while ago, a year or so ago, because you were involved with a project that I had heard about called Safe Sets, Dying to Work in the Film Industry. But as I looked at what you were up to, so we'll talk about that, but I want to kind of get into, you know, what, like, I found so interesting about your work is that you focus a lot on healthy production, well-being. Can you speak a little bit about what that is, what you think about when you're thinking about healthy production?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that anybody out there who's ever worked on a set would not use the word healthy to describe the culture of it. It's kind of ironic to even be talking about that. Especially as someone who, as I mentioned, I fell so in love with production. Like, I love the lingo. I love wearing a walkie-talkie. I loved all of it. I love being on set. I love joking with the crew and crafty and all the things. And I think that, like, what happens on a set is that there's this amazing, expansive, joyful act of creation that we all understand. And then there's also this underbelly of it, which requires us to sacrifice our health, sacrifice ourselves for the good of the production. And, you know, we've all experienced this. It could be like insane hours, being exhausted. On set, sometimes I'll just like drink a Celsius and then just like eat a bunch of gummy bears. And I'm like, whoa, I don't do that in my everyday life. But for some reason on set, I get into survival mode. And so I'm a big believer that the underbelly part is not required for the creative process and actually is something that detracts from it. Because when we are in survival mode, when we're fighting for our lives and feel like we're at war on set, we're actually not doing our best work. And it's not sustainable to have a career that is based on that. So I'm very passionate about, you know, innovating production and changing the culture to be something that's more supportive of us as human beings.
I'm just curious how you think we got to this culture in the first place. Because I'm, you know, like, I didn't go to film school. I kind of just, you know, walked on set and started working. And so I'm just, is this like taught in film school? Is this just like kind of just, you know, it's kind of lingered year over year, decade over decade? Like, how did we get to this kind of culture, you think?
I'm so glad you asked, because they did not. I don't know about all the film schools out there. Maybe somebody learned this in film school. I certainly didn't. And I think actually, in terms of the history of production, I think that there's a lot of like shrouding of the systems of production intentionally because they want people to focus on what's in front of the camera. It's like the Wizard of Oz. Like,
yeah,
look at what's in front of the camera. Don't look back here. And we like our BTS and that kind of thing. But there's so much more information on like the history of cinema than on the systems of production.
Right.
So yeah, it's so several years ago, I did a lot of research myself. I had to really deep dive and going into like academic articles from the 1970s and just like finding this information. And what I pieced together was that, you know, the dawn of Hollywood was in the 1910s. Mm-hmm. And at that time, World War I was going on. And Henry Ford had just come out with the assembly line in 1913. So if you just put yourself in that time, mm-hmm. people were still riding around in horse-drawn carriages for the most part. Like, people didn't own a refrigerator. This is like, you know, the dawn of early cinema. And when motion pictures came on the scene, like, audiences were ravenous for them. They could not get enough. You know, you think about those things like, people at Nickelodeons with like the train coming out of the screen and they're like, oh my God. And so the demand, it was so high for motion pictures. And these early tycoons of Hollywood, these producers, they could not make movies fast enough. Mm-hmm. Because at the time, the director would write, edit, direct, they would do everything. So they could only make one motion picture at a time. And it was very slow. So what these guys figured out, and literally it was like a handful of guys in top hats. Like, you know, we think about like that's this whole system was their idea. They looked around and they said, okay, we have to build a more efficient system. Let's base it off of the military, World War I. Let's base it off of the assembly line, Factory of Dreams. So they modeled Hollywood to mirror those systems. And of course, as we know, they made more movies, they made more money, Hollywood grew and expanded. And over the past 100 years, the technology of filmmaking has completely evolved. And really, these systems have not evolved. We continue to replicate the way that we work. And I think without a lot of questioning of those systems and whether they're a fit for today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like the tech has evolved, which we even talk about now a lot, you know, clean tech and all that stuff. The tech has evolved, but the human systems haven't evolved. Is that kind of like that's a distinction there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. If you think about like, you know, again, I was saying at that time, they didn't have sound or color when they were making films. These are black and white silent films that they designed the system to produce. And we're using the same system that was designed for that to film like, you know, stuff on volumes or like with AI and, you know, all the drones and all the things that we have now. We're using the same system that was created by a handful of guys to make silent movies in like an abandoned grocery store.
Yeah, and it's interesting too from a gear and equipment perspective, right? I mean, everything's hardened for field deployment, for you know, there's a lot of similarities to a lot of the electrical distro and ways that they do things to how you would potentially in a military operation or something like that in the field. So I thought that was interesting too when I started looking at the power side, you know. So it's, yeah, there definitely are a lot of parallels, but it is a traveling circus / roadshow / you know, you got to be able to set up full infrastructure in literally hours.
100%. Yeah, Mark, I'm glad you mentioned that too. I mean, it's like, if you think about, again, back to the history, these early cameras were designed to replicate guns. They were designed to film animals in the wild, and they were modeled after the revolver. That's not like a coincidence. And if you think like, cut to today, you look at like Red cameras, there's the arsenal, there's the rocket, the weapon. They talk about these things are battle tested. I mean, I was on a job with a DP, and we were filming kittens in my office for this small project. And he's like, I got to figure out what the right weapons are for the battle. I'm like, what battle, bro? We're filming kittens in the office. Like, what? The mentality is so, to your point, boots on the ground, running gun, we're shotgun mic, we're going to kill it, we're going to die over here, we're in the trenches. And my thesis about that is that that's created. It's not true. It's a culture. It's a culture. Like, we can treat production in that way, but we could also treat production as something like creative and life-giving and fun. It doesn't necessarily have to be even a traveling roadshow or a circus. That's a paradigm, right? That we can all exist inside of. And then we're juggling and we're on the tightrope, but like, it's not more true than the idea that production is a ballet. I mean, they're all metaphors.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what's interesting and how you're talking about this and kind of the words that we use, the language we use, is that when you say them, you believe it. Or when you hear it, it's a constant reinforcement of the grind or the, you know, the culture that, you know, that is, you know, permeating film and TV. So it's
and hard. Corporate culture too, just for the record. I mean, this is not limited to film and TV.
Oh, totally. Totally. You know?
Yeah.
But I think, you know, we've talked about it before on this podcast, like the language we use matters, you know, it sends a message, a signal, you believe it, like it shapes how you think and, you know, all of it. So, so that's really interesting. So in that, you know, how do you set up a production or how do you, create a culture, a healthy culture, or a culture of well-being or conscious production. I have that in the show notes too. Like, how do you create that then? What language do you use? How do you approach it?
I think it starts with the intention first and foremost, like is to have an intention that people on set feel like cared for.
Yeah.
The crew in particular. And to say that that's like revolutionary is upsetting, but also a fact. Like, you know, I really started with just orienting around the crew's experience. That was the first step for me. And like, you know, I work in short form, I work in commercials. We understand how to provide a great experience for people on set because we provide it to the talent and the agency and client on every shoot. But for some reason, it's just like we limit it to those people and we don't expand it to the rest of the crew. But it's so simple to just expand providing a great experience to the crew. It really is like it's a thinking thing. I think that's how it began. You know, like one thing that, you know, we have a policy that's like Starbucks for all. So, you know, very common in commercials, you'll see the people in Video Village, they get their coffee orders and then like, everybody else is looking at them, drink their matchas, like reinforcing these ideas that they don't matter and the people on the leather couches do matter. And so whenever the agency wants a coffee run on set, I do a coffee run for everyone on the crew. Is that more expensive? Sure, but marginally. And when someone walks around and asks a grip, like for their coffee order, what that does to that grip in terms of their feeling of being cared for, belonging, excitement, it pays back tenfold for the way that that grip then engages with the project for the rest of the day. So it's like, it's just a paradigm shift, I think. I mean, there's so many more things we could talk about and get into, but I think that's really the most fundamental one is orienting around a culture of care.
Yeah. Like you said, it seems quite simple and straightforward, and it's crazy that we have to say that out loud, but it is very true, and that, you know, this human element is not like top of mind a lot of the time. And it's like, how much can we get out of these people almost, and not like, you know, how can we all work together, you know, be a cohesive unit and, you know, care for each other to get the best product on the screen, something to that effect.
Well, it's like morale, though. I mean, I think it's something like that, right? I mean, you get so much more when people are intrinsically motivated and inspired. You know, you don't need to have 18-hour days. Maybe you can get it done in 12 hours or whatever it is. Like, I'm sure there's some, I mean, have you seen that direct, you know, correlation to that, you know, your crew being motivated to do the right thing, the best thing in a shorter amount of time? Or is it a time thing? I mean, is it a quality thing? Like, how are you seeing the end product as a result of inspiring your crew and making them feel, you know, part of something greater?
Yeah, it's a great point. And I think the thing that's never made sense to me is that we're in a creative industry. We're not in a factory making widgets. We're in a creative industry. And creativity is life force inside of us. And when we are using a system that's extractive to the planet, that's extractive to human beings, to their energy, that doesn't communicate with them, we're not getting the best out of people. Like, even if you don't care about people as a way of being, you care about making the best product, right? And it doesn't, the way that we're working does not make the best product, because you can walk around set and like, you see people not engaged. You know, you see, if you walk around and ask like the VTR operator on a commercial set, what are you working on? They don't even know. They're like, maybe they know the name of the client. They don't understand what they're working on because nobody has brought them into the vision. And I find that like we're leaving so much productivity, engagement, and creativity on the table as a result of that. And so simply by like explaining to them what we're doing and like that their contribution matters and how it fits in, it is a qualitative thing, I think, for the time being, around like how much better the work is and how the experience is. Mm-hmm. You know, we could talk more about safe sets, and there's a survey that's going to be happening. I think the thing that we are missing is data about, you know, these things. We don't have it in the U.S. They have a lot of data around mental health and the way that people feel on set in the U.K. We're not quite there. I think that's the more qualitative information that we could use to show the difference in like the way that something performs after people are being treated better. Mm-hmm. But I will say that I think, if there's a production going on and there's a crisis, like a huge problem, all the time, I look for what's going on between people. Because if you have a crisis on your set, it's not about that. Something is off between the interpersonal dynamics of the team 100% of the time. So to your point, Mark, like when we're working in a way where people are coherent, when there's good morale, when we're dealing with issues between people before they blow up, we don't have crises on set. It does not happen. We can have something pops up, but then we deal with it, but it doesn't become a full-blown crisis. So I think that's the value of this as well.
Well, and also conflict resolution. And let's be honest, most of us were not taught that even at home from our own parents. Right? Like, I mean, it really goes back all the way to that. And that's something that I think a lot about too, because from a business perspective or in the boardroom or whatever, it's like, it's really how you resolve conflict and how you move through that and how you communicate. And this fundamental stuff that no one, especially with the boomer parent generation, like they didn't know how. They still don't know how. So I think it's
exactly
that too.
Yeah. I also, and this has come up recently for me, so it's the front of mind, but just even the ability to discuss and debate has fallen kind of behind. And like, it's okay to disagree and talk through things and figure out, you know, the best solution, you know, and we don't, because of the hierarchy in film and TV, like we don't, like people don't want to talk to supervisors for, you know, and kind of exchange ideas because anyway, it's, I find that is also limiting as well. So.
Absolutely. I mean, well, this is the culture part of the conversation,
exactly, right?
Because you're talking about also, Mark, you're talking about conflict resolution, but we just established that this system is designed on conflict, like war. It's modeled after war. So how are you going to use a system that's like war and then inside of that have conflict resolution? Like, this is why I think we need to change all that. And yeah, to your point, Zena, it's like, there are people with ideas and people may see something and not say something because they don't have psychological safety. Exactly. And is that what's best for the production? No, that could be a huge lawsuit or an insurance claim. And like, these are the kinds of things that I think, you know, always point back to what's going on between people. And this is like why we need as an industry to really focus differently on the culture and what's going on between people, because it has so many threads of impact.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, speaking of impacts, can we shift gears a little bit to Safe Sets? Tell us a little bit about that project and what's the latest there?
Yeah, so Safe Sets is an incredible documentary film. It really is.
I know. Yeah.
It's so good. And I feel like I could say that too. You know, I mean, I could say that if I started on it from the beginning, but I came on board after it was already made because I saw it and I was like, this is a film that needs to be seen. This is a film that speaks to all the things that we're speaking about now.
Yeah.
So it's a documentary directed by a doctor from Harvard named Dr. Paul Heinzelman. He's a public health specialist. And during COVID, he started working on set doing COVID testing. And he also does cast insurance exams. And so as an outsider, he came onto film sets and was like, whoa, there are so many public health issues going on here. And he originally started, he was going to do like a YouTube how-to series about like how to lift things better. But it continued to expand. And what it became is a feature documentary that really looks at these different pillars of production culture that are issues when it comes to public health, including stunts, how unregulated stunts are, toxic chemicals, how unregulated toxic chemicals are on set and harmful they are to our health, sleep deprivation, which we all know is a huge issue when it comes to mental acuity and safety, addiction, power abuse. It's really the first time that all of these issues, I think, have been addressed in one place. And it tells through the stories of people who have dealt with this on set, and unfortunately, many of whom have lost their lives, looks at that and also starts to, offer an alternative. Like, well, what are we going to do about this? And talks about stories like Sarah Jones, which those of you out there might have heard of, and what happened on the set of Rust and these kinds of things. So it's a very, it's a bit of a downer, but it's also a bit of an upper because we have to really get our arms around this before we can create change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's almost a microcosm for our general world around us, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I saw it. Well, Mark, you know someone who worked a bit on it as well, our friend Carrie Coombs. I think she helped on it. She's the one that brought it to me, I don't know, over maybe a year ago. I don't know. It's been a long time. And I watched it and I was like, I cannot, like this, like I was so excited that it had been made. Because I'm like, finally, there's something to show that shows what, I've observed, lots of people have observed, right? And anyway, but I knew a couple of people who had been interviewed in the film because they're in Vancouver, BC. And so I was like, oh my gosh, like, I worked with that guy. It's like a small world, even in that. But it's fantastic, to have this out there to start the conversation. Because otherwise I feel like, the conversation of safety and why, all these questions of why does this happen or that happen is like, definitely stays behind the scenes.
Yeah, I think the thing too is that it's like it can tend to be anecdotal. Like we hear about what happened on the set of Yes, like, whoa, that was crazy. Or, oh, we hear about this other thing that happened. And then we're like, whoa, that was crazy. But when it takes putting them all together to kind of reveal the fact that this is actually a systemic issue, it's not incidental here and there. And there are things that are happening, you know, to the point what we're talking about in the culture mm-hmm. on these sets before it leads to somebody losing their life. There's things that are happening before that. Like on the set of Rust, you know, there were so many issues that were happening. There were two accidental firearm discharges and an explosion discharge before the one that killed Halyna Hutchins and shot and Joel and injured Joel Souza. Like there are things, the camera crew walked off the set the morning of because they weren't being compensated properly or provided with accommodation. So it's like there are things that then ultimately led to that incident, but we have to look at what's happening beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Are you getting pushback or, you know, because we're obviously this, you know, there's a lot of different folks within the film industry that may not want to change how they do business or may be threatened by this. How are you coming across that? Or is it being well received by certain folks? You don't need to name anybody per se, but I just mean like, what's the general sentiment around this film and around actually being serious about changing that culture, especially in a world right now where we seem to be regressing a little bit on a lot of things?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're very right about that. I think there's the reception is all over the board. I think for crews, it's very powerful. I've been personally and facilitated conversation with crew members after they watched it. There's so much trauma that I think we've never really acknowledged inside of ourselves from working on set because we just keep going and being like, wait a minute, like this is actually not okay. And having opportunities to speak about that and process it. It reminds me a lot of what happened with me too. You know, for those of us who've worked in the industry forever, like, of course I was sexually harassed. I was told derogatory things and I was like, ha, that's how it is. And then once Me Too happened, I was like, wait a minute, actually, that's really not okay, those things that happened. And I feel like this topic is very similar. Like, there's a lot of things that are not okay that are happening on set. So I think the crews are very, very grateful that this is being spoken about. To your point, some of those more powerful people, you know, I don't want to get into that necessarily, but there's definitely people out there who don't want the film to be seen or who feel that their role as organizations is to protect the crew and don't want anything out there about how the crew's not being protected. So you're absolutely right. There are systems of power, but we're starting the self-distribution process and we really, it's time for people to see the film and to share about it and to talk about it and to use it as a tool for advocacy and change. So yeah, we'll see. I'm sure there's going to be all sorts of responses once it gets out there fully.
Yeah. And I'm sure everyone will see it, right? Because it's a small community where people talk, right? And it's going to spread.
Yes. Let's hope so.
I think so.
Has to.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier there's a survey associated or will be associated with it.
Yeah. So the film is about how Dr. Heinzelman is starting, he's attempting to do a study with Harvard on film worker safety, and it's moving forward and everything is good. And then right when it gets to the point where it's about to happen and it's funded and the unions pull out. And so that's in the film. That's kind of the narrative arc of Safe Sets. And so it's a very disappointing thing that like we got close and it didn't happen.
Of course. His car blows up.
Yeah.
Well, not.
Safely. So now there is some renewed interest, and I think we'll be talking more about that soon, for that survey to move forward. Finally, after all these years, it seems like that's going to move forward in terms of getting data around film worker health and safety so that we can have the quantitative information to start bringing to the powers that be.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah. And there's some parallels here to the, you know, sustainability is kind of a really broad term. But, you know, we see a lot of the same, cultural shifts and resistance and so on. So, I mean, that's what Zena and I have been doing on this, but you're bringing in a whole other element to it. So hopefully they meet somewhere in the middle, right? Where wellness on set is also not breathing in diesel fumes and dealing and just innovating in that front too. So, I mean, that's part of what we're doing. And we're also trying to evolve the word sustainability. Sustainable, what does that even mean, right?
Thank you.
It's like, come on, let's do this. So we're still playing with that. And if you have any ideas on that, we're all ears as well. But there is a wellness component. But even that word is overdone. I mean, this is the challenge with this all this stuff, right? There's just a lot of buzzwords. And then they seem to get lost in the fray. So yeah, we're always thinking about that and open to ideas.
I'd love to hear from the listeners too about their ideas about that. I completely agree. Like, to me, sustainability is not the goal. That's like maintaining the status quo, which is not a good idea. And I think wellness is an industry. I don't use the word wellness at all. I think that's an industry that points to, you know, a certain thing, like, you know, yoga, sound baths and supplements. And I think like I've been recently thinking about it more as like having a healthy production. And inside of the idea of a healthy production, we need like mental health, physical health, environmental health, economic health, emotional health, like all of those things.
I see a circular diagram, a regenerative diagram. What's it sort?
I love regenerative too, because I think, you know, the reason that I'm also very, very passionate about sustainability, for lack of a better word, because to me, it's the same thing. You can't separate these. You can't separate the way that people are abused on set from the way that we are abusing the planet from, you know, it's all the same thing. It's all the same impetus in us as human beings under a system of capitalism to extract. Yes. And so when we start thinking about this as like regenerating, how do we regenerate the planet? How do we regenerate people? It goes everywhere. It's not siloed. It's the whole system. So I think that this is the same movement. It's not separate. The movement for a healthy production is not separate from sustainability. It's not separate from, you know, dismantling racism on set or sexism. It's all the same. Yeah, it's all the same
systems,
movement.
Agriculture.
Yeah. It's all connected. Yeah. Yeah, I totally. And then I saw one of your articles that you wrote talked about the idea of having a well-being coordinator or someone focused on that on set. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that works?
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, the language, I don't know. Anybody out there got any ideas? We're workshopping it. In the UK, they say well-being facilitator. I went through a training. That's a role in the UK. If you watch the credits of a lot of films or TV that were filmed in the UK, they often have somebody in a role of well-being. And that's somebody who's dedicated to the mental health of the cast, the crew, the producers. And so I absolutely think we have to have a role on set. Because if you work on set, you know, nothing happens unless you have somebody in that position. You want somebody's hair to look good? You need a hair person. It's not like the prop stylist is going to look at the hair.
Touch up a little hair.
Yeah. We're so hyper-specialized on set. And we can't expect that, like, well-being is going to be the role of the production coordinator. Like, we need somebody whose role it is. And I think that's going to be a great start to having this change. And what does that role look like? I mean, we'll see what they're doing. But even just a person, I have someone on my sets, shout out to JJ, he's often in this role on our sets, and he calls himself the curator of vibes. And so his whole role is to morale, like to make sure to check in with people, how are people doing? And like, you know, you need someone in a role that's taking care of the-
He's a host, kind of like a host.
Exactly.
Or like Rick Rubin, you know, what does he do? He's vibe guy.
The vibe guy, or like he's like a hype man, or like, a, yeah, I don't know. You could think of a lot of different paradigms. And there's also a lot of roles that are doing this already. Like we have intimacy coordinators, you know, there are people that are in these kinds of roles, sustainability coordinator. I feel that we need like a department inside which all of those individual roles can sit.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Because people are focused on different things and, you know, you can't like, you know, squeeze it all into one person because then it's, you know, part of what they do gets, you know, deprioritized. So
it's like what you were telling me, Zena. You know, we were talking about this. I was mentioning that a lot of intimacy coordinators on set have been saying that people are coming to them with all sorts of issues that are not about their job because they're in a position of care. And so people are desperate. They're like, crew members are like, help us. And the intimacy coordinator is like, that's not my job. I mean, you mentioned that about being outside of sustainability. Yeah.
Well, this was, gosh, probably over 10 years ago in one of my first, like very first productions. And I was in this role of sustainability coordinator or whatever, sustainability, we just made up titles. and one of the construction guys found me on the lot and asked if I could help because they had been working 28 days straight without a break. And he was afraid that, you know, they're tired or worn out. They could injure themselves and asked if I could help because I'm the sustainability person. I was like, whoa, I don't know. So, you know, without really having much experience, I'm running around asking people about this.
Probably like,
nobody would help me.
Stay in your lane.
Nobody, like I never really got an answer. So I would go check on those guys every day. I would just go over, see how they're doing, you know, have a little chat, you know, but like I didn't know what to do then and no one would help me figure this out. Like the safety guy was from the studio who wasn't there all the time, you know, that kind of thing. So it's really strange. So
I've heard that happening also with like ASPCA, is what we call it in the US, right? Like with animal people who are there to make sure the animals are treated well, crew going to those people and being like, we're not being treated well. And the person being like, sorry, I'm only here to take care of the animals.
Yeah.
Let that fit in for a moment.
Wild world. And again, you know, like it's so crazy because my mind just keeps going back to more corporate stuff because I've worked in corporate and what, like, it's just, it's uncanny. Right, like it's in every aspect of our lives, at least in North America,
working world,
yeah,
right.
So wild. It's.
But do you see that they're doing more in corporate to address this than in other areas?
Depends on the corporate stuff. But then again, the problem is the pendulum also swung way too much in corporate, in some corporate stuff, and people started to get pushed back and really disenfranchised, like the whole thing around microaggressions and all stuff like that. Like there are people taking microaggression training, right? And eventually, like, this is what swings that pendulum way back on the other side, right? It's not, you can't just go all the way here and treat everybody like this, like softest little, right? Like, it's just like, we're somewhere in the middle, right? And I think that's where there's a common sense element to it, right? It's like, are we healthy? Are we feeling good? Or what are we doing? So yeah, I think a lot about that, right? Especially as being a two-time CEO company, right? When I go to do something, grow another company, like this is stuff I'm thinking about, mm-hmm. right? It's like, it's just relationships as people and just people want to be heard and seen, right? And that's not that hard, but we have to retrain ourselves and we have to go back there. We have to be aware of that. So yeah, I love this work.
It's very, so great.
Very important work. So what's next? What's next? And then where can people find out more about, your work?
What's next? Mark, I wish I knew. Changing the whole industry from the bottom up. I mean, you know, continuing to do this work. And I think, you know, there's a lot brewing and partnering with organizations within Hollywood who are passionate about this. So there's definitely things happening. I'm very excited about to see on the systems level and how can we strategically work with studios, with unions, with insurance companies? How can we be elegant in our approach to making healthy sets a more viable reality here in the US. And I also think it's really, I'm always so inspired when I see people in the zeitgeist working in different ways. You know, I'm so like Chloe Zhao, the way that she approached production on Hamnet, which was so beautiful, so much about the collective, very much a set with emotional health and safety. I don't know that she would language it that way, but incredible. And then you also see Clint Bentley and Greg Dwidar from Train Dreams. They have this whole economic model where there's profit sharing and points on the back end for the crew, which is very innovative. And you see Daniels, who directed Everything Everywhere All at Once, you know, having dance parties or working in these different ways on set. And so I think I've been doing this work for decades, and I have not seen that in the cultural zeitgeist in the way that I'm seeing it now. So I feel very inspired that this movement is growing. There's more and more people talking about this, more and more people pushing this forward. So I really do think that things are going to change in the next year to few years. We're going to see this become a much, much bigger conversation than it is now. I'm here for it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think we are too.
Absolutely.
We're out there pushing the envelope in various ways. So yeah, really excited about this. And really thank you for the work that you're doing and the way you're inspiring folks on set. And I think it makes for just good all around. So thank you for your work on that and talking to us about this.
My pleasure. And then to answer your question about where people can find us, you know, safesetsmovie.org, safe sets with a T, like that, sets. Yeah. Do the other thing too, but that's not what we're talking about. Safesetsmovie.org. My production company is called The Light, thelight.nyc. You can also find us on Instagram at The Light Is Lit. So we'd love to hear from you. Yeah. Thanks so much.
All right. Becky Morrison, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Our designer is Aaliyah Kane. Music is by Peter Chapman. Social media is by Sharon Ewan. Our editor and producer is Rachel Werbel.